Early in 2006, Mark Seale read a brief, very brief story about the murder of a woman in Kenya. Joan Root was 69. She lived on a gorgeous lake in Kenya and used to be in wildlife movies. Mark Seale joins us from the studios of Colorado Public Radio. What did that story set off in you?
Well, it was a one-paragraph mention in the New York Times Facts, and it just said, conservationist killed, 69 years old, murdered in her home on Lake Naivasha for mysterious reasons. And it also said she and her husband, Alan, had been nominated for an Oscar for a film they had made about a termite mound. I said, wow, who was this woman? And what did she do? And why did she die?
Mark Seale, let us explain, has written a book about Joan Root's life and death called Wildflower. She was famously beautiful. Her husband, Alan Root, a famous daredevil. And in a way, they fell in love over a baby elephant.
They did. Joan and her father, who ran safaris in Kenya, had found a baby elephant in the bottom of a well. And Joan had a magical way with animals. She grew up in the wild, and she was determined to save this baby elephant. So she and Alan came over to help her save this elephant. And the elephant sadly died. And when the elephant died, she turned to Alan, and they fell in love.
We should explain, Alan kept a baby bungo in his room. Not what Ricky Ricardo played at the nightclub. Yeah.
Exactly. They're antelopes. And Alan had not only kept a baby bungo in his room when he was a teenager, he kept a baboon in his room and a snake farm in his backyard. Yeah. These were two nature lovers who came together as a team, and they became arguably the most famous wildlife filmmakers in the world.
They were bigger in the 1970s than Steve Irwin was a few decades later.
They were huge. They were the first to film wildlife without human interaction. Before March of the Penguins and Winged Migration, they were filming animals doing what animals do.
They loved each other, but I think it's safe to say that when it came to marital fidelity, Alan Root imitated some of the beasts that he photographed.
Yes, Alan had an affair with another woman, and they divorced, and Joan was absolutely devastated.
Yeah.
But then what's amazing about this woman is no matter what happened to her, she would always rise up stronger, more resolute. And the second half of her life, I think, was even more amazing than the first.
Tell us about that, because she set up camp in Lake Naivasha.
Yes. You drive out of Nairobi and you look across the Great Rift Valley, the cradle of civilization, and you see this lake shimmering in the distance like a silver mirage. Joan had and Alan had lived there in the happiest part of their marriage. And after their divorce, Joan went home to Naivasha, but things had changed. It was like she was walking into a nightmare. This lake is like Dr. Doolittle times 1,000. It's filled with hippos. There's giraffe in the area, zebra. There's 350 species of birds. But when she went back, it was overrun with poachers. The fish were being poached. The wildlife she loved were being slaughtered. And she was seeing her world disappear.
And she just didn't accept it silently.
This, I think, was the turning point in Joan Root's life. This shy, quiet woman stood up and did something about the situation.
She did?
She and also some of the other landowners around the lake created what was called the task force. Joan wanted to rehabilitate a group of poachers to make them legal fishermen. And what they eventually did is they created a team of these men, half legal fishermen and half illegal fishermen or poachers, to police the lake.
Security situation in her place on the lake sounds, unendurable by most standards.
Right. With the influx of unemployed and destitute people came an epidemic of crime. Joan had been carjacked. She had been broken into. It was so bad that the white landowners around the lake had taken to putting bars on their windows and steel doors in their homes, but she wouldn't leave.
And why? I mean, this is Joan Root. She could have, I'm filling in the blanks here, picked up and gone to Britain.
She could have done anything. She could have gone anywhere. But I feel like she had lost one love of her life, her husband. And I don't think she was going to lose the second love of her life, her land. And so she stayed.
The official finding of the court was that some people broke into her house. It was a robbery attempt gone bad.
Exactly. At 1 a.m. on January 13, 2006, two men wearing masks or hoods came walking down her property through this little orphanage where she kept her animals on the mend, and they walked up to her bedroom. And by then, her bedroom was surrounded by steel doors and bars on the windows, and she was essentially living like an animal in a cage. That's how bad crime had gotten there. And so these two men, one with an AK-47, the other with a Panga, a one-sided machete, said, "Open up." She wouldn't do it. There was a security team living on her property by then, and she called the security man who was heading this team. And so she said, he told her, "Get on the floor." And next thing he could hear her on her cell phone, he heard the gunshots. They unloaded the AK-47 in the windows, and Joan Root was dead.
Doesn't sound like a robbery.
No, it doesn't. The police were convinced that it was a robbery, but all of her friends said and insisted that it was an assassination attempt because of her conservation activities on the lake. Four men were arrested, and then at the trial, the judge said the evidence was virtually non-existent. They were essentially acquitted. And so he let the men go free, and to this day, Joan's death remains a mystery, and whoever did it is still at large.
What did Alan Root wind up doing with her ashes?
Alan planted the ashes on her land with a fig tree over them.
And what did he say, all tied up with the roots or something?
Yes, that was great. You know, Alan's a great wit, and he says she'll always be surrounded by roots. And I went to the memorial. It was about a month after Joan's death. Hundreds of wildlife filmmakers, naturalists, local Kenyans, black and white, were there to mourn and to celebrate this incredibly brave and courageous woman. And it was just one more domino to fall in a way of this beautiful country that has had so much violence and so much turmoil in recent years.
Mr. Seale, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Mark Seale, his new book is Wildflower, An Extraordinary Life and Untimely Death in Africa.
Batman is dead. Neil Gaiman, the man who bade him farewell, joins us in just a moment. His two-part series, Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader, has just been collected in a hardback edition, and the celebrated writer of The Sandman and many other comics and novels, including American Gods, describes this as a final love letter to a character whose persona has changed many times in different eras of the comics, in the old live-action show on TV, and several animated series, and, of course, in the movies. Neil Gaiman joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Congratulations. Nice to have you back on the program.
It's lovely to be back, Neil.
And which is your Batman?
Oh, that's a hard one. In many ways, I did Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader so that I didn't have to choose. Mm-hmm. I got to try and put all of them in there, even the Adam West one. The first one is always probably the most impressive, and obviously I'm of a generation where that was the TV show.
The TV show is with the Adam West you're talking about.
The original Adam West TV show.
Biff, Pam, Pow.
Absolutely. And of course, what was great about that, though, was I was 6-7 years old when it came to England. So I didn't regard it in any way as camp or funny. I used to worry. They'd do those cliffhanger endings at the end of everything, and there would be Batman and Robin tied to a balloon being sent off into the air to die a horrible death with a cackling Joker or grinning Penguin. And I would worry for a week until the next episode came on and they got out.
They eventually went to two episodes a week, so you were doubly troubled.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it was very worrying.
What you're talking about, bringing all of those characters back in this one two-part comic book, that involves some interesting writing. You have to work very closely with your artist, for one thing.
I was incredibly lucky. I don't think I could have done this thing. And whatever happened to the Caped Crusader is essentially a two-part Batman story. I was asked if I'd like to write something that would be a two-part story that could be the last episode of Batman comics and then the last episode of Detective Comics, mm-hmm. where Batman started all those years ago.
Detective. DC Comics is called Detective Comics because it's DC Detective Comics.
Exactly. And in Detective Comics number 27, back in 1939, Batman made his first appearance. So it was very fitting that the last Batman story in Detective got to be... they got to be in Detective.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the point where they told me that I could have Andy Kubert as my artist that I got really excited and thought, okay, I could probably do this completely mad thing where I get to talk about every single aspect of Batman or all the ones I've ever cared about and even some of the ones that I didn't. And I can put them all in there. And I can get... because Andy is somebody who could draw like Frank Miller, like Brian Bolland, but he could also draw like these people like Dick Sprang, these forgotten 40s Batman artists. And I was able to, I hope, to at least doff my cap to all of them, to, you know, 70 years of Batman.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking with Neil Gaiman. You may have seen his film Coraline most recently in 3D. That was pretty cool. Let's go to David. David with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, which is your Batman?
Adam West.
Adam West. What attracted you to that particular Batman?
Well, Adam West, his mother used to live in Oregon at a hotel on the Oregon coast, and I think it was one New Year's Eve, my sister actually had dinner with him, and I met him, and he was an interesting man.
So you actually went to dinner with Adam West, the Batman?
Right. Well, my sister was the attendee at the dinner. I was just on looking.
Well, that's as good as anything. Can I get your autograph?
I'll try.
All right, David. Thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Let's see if we go next to Jared. Jared with us from Shawnee in Kansas.
Hi, Neil. Neil.
One of us spells his name properly, but go ahead.
My first Batman would be, I was about 5 years old when Batman the movie came out. And I actually got to read my first Batman comic right after the movie on going to a pizza store, and they had a signing from someone in a Batman costume there. But I wanted to ask Mr. Gaiman, I've been a big fan of your work for a long time, but how was your two-parter, Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader, influenced by Alan Moore's Superman story, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Jared, thanks very much. And of course, Batman, not the first character to die in the comic books. Go ahead.
It wasn't really. I was actually quite surprised when I learned that I was going to call it Batman the End, and then I learned that DC had actually titled it Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader, to basically clarify for people that it was the same kind of thing as Alan Moore's wonderful last Superman story back in, I think it was about 1985-86. Alan did, which was so brilliant and so beautiful, was essentially bid farewell to the Mort Weisinger era, the Silver Age Superman. He got everything that made that era what it was in his story, and you had something that was basically a love letter from Alan to the things he loved about Superman, most of which were going to finish at that point. What I got to do, rather than try and pick a specific era of Batman to say goodbye to, was to essentially try and celebrate the entire thing, to say that the glory of Batman is that, you know, yes, he's dead in the comics right now, and everybody in comics gets to stay dead until they get up and get better again. That's the rule. So I was going to, I wanted to acknowledge that. And I wanted to acknowledge and glory in all of the different creators, all of the different aspects of Batman, including the original Batman movie, including the most recent versions, including Neil Adams, a wonderful Batman artist, and you know, a third Neil to be mentioned on this show, who also didn't spell his name correctly. He spelt it like Neil Conan. Neil Adams, who re-imaged, who gave us the longer, pointier ears, the more swirlingy cloak, the put Batman back at night, back in the 70s, and essentially made him cool again after the Adam West version of Batman had uncooled him ultimately. So I got to try and say, talk about how much I loved all of those things, and of course have essentially the same format that Alan had, which is you get the last issue with that numbering of your comic. But I don't think that you could look at them as being the same kind of thing at all.
I asked this question to the man who did so much with the Sandman. Is Batman the most interesting character in comics?
I've never thought of any character as being the most interesting character in comics. I don't think there is a the most interesting character in comics, because the truth is, characters are as good as you write them. Hmm. And the glory of great characters and the glory of great writers and creators is that point where you put a wonderful creator on a second, third, fourth, or even a fifth string character, and suddenly you have Frank Miller doing Daredevil and everybody going, oh, Daredevil was such a great character. Or Alan Moore doing Swamp Thing, who was just considered a joke. I think what you get in that mainstream comics thing is you get out of it what the creator is willing to put into it. The joy of Batman, I think, is that he is, A, incredibly old now. He's been around since our grandparents and our great-grandparents' days. And that allows you to have an awful lot of history to play with. On the other hand, I think that he became the archetype of all of the vengeful Avengers of the night. But I do think the problem that you can get in with Batman in that kind of situation is you can look at it and go, well, every story has been told. They have all been done before. Which was why I started, I think one of the things that attracted me to it was just the idea of, okay, tell the last Batman story. What would the last Batman story be?
And you came out of retirement to do that. You had said many times before you didn't want to write comic books anymore.
I did. Definitely said that I didn't want to write any mainstream superhero comics anymore. And I lurched out of retirement because they phoned me up and they said, would you like to write the last Batman story? And I thought, you know, I'll probably screw it up. But then at least that way it'll be me screwing it up as opposed to somebody else. And I will screw it up with love and passion.
We're talking with Neil Gaiman. Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusaders Deluxe Edition, a collection of the two-part final story of Batman, is out today in comic book stores and next week in bookstores. And he's joining us from Minnesota Public Radio. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, who was your Batman, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's get Jennifer on the line. Jennifer with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm a tremendous fan of Neil Gaiman's, and I've read pretty much everything he's written. I went to the comic book shop the day that Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader came out and bought a copy of both covers. Read them, and I was heartbroken, mostly because Batman is my favorite comic book character, and Neil Gaiman is my favorite author, and the way that what happened with Alfred just lurched at my heartstrings. I'm not going to give any spoilers for those who haven't read
it. Well, he dies at the end, but, you know, it's... Jennifer, I have to say I had this... I was halfway through that last, you know, collected volume of The Sandman, and I had to stop because I couldn't bear it anymore.
No, I just loved all of that, but that was in my darker gothic days when I was a teenager back in the 80s.
did you dress like death?
I did. I used to go out dancing, dressed with eye makeup and the ankh and all that crazy stuff.
Jennifer, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it.
I also wanted to congratulate Neil Gaiman on his Newbery for a graveyard book, which I have my eldest son reading right now, and I had my husband read Snow, Glass, and Apples last night for the first time.
Thank you
so much.
I got to go to the actual Newbery dinner the other night and be presented with the Newbery Medal, and it was such an honor. And the American Library Association, and wonderful thing to get.
All this stuff, the movies, the comic books, the novels, that's where the real money is, too. It's children's books.
Is it? Yeah. I don't know. My theory on this, 25, 27 years ago, something like that, I wrote my first book for money, and it was a biography of Duran Duran that I was asked to write, and I did. And it sold out the first week it came out, and the second week it came out, the publisher went into bankruptcy, and I never got the royalties. And I looked around and I went, you know, I just did something. I wrote a book that I probably wouldn't have ever wanted to read for money, and I didn't get the money. I don't think I'll do that anymore. And so the only thing that's actually made my career, what there is of it, have any sense ever since, is just doing the stuff you think is interesting. And the money normally follows. And if it doesn't, you've done something that was interesting.
Let's talk with Dominique. Dominique with us from Lafayette in Louisiana.
Yes, hi. How's it going?
Good.
I'm actually calling from my local comic shop right now, out buying the first issue of Blackest Night. But for my favorite Batman, I'm going to probably say that it's honestly the new one right now, Dick Grayson in the comic books. And the reason why is just because that I feel that with Dick Grayson learning to become Batman after being Robin for the longest time, it was a good jumping on point for me to read Batman comics, and so I could learn about Batman as Dick Grayson's learning about being Batman.
So it is always being reborn.
Oh, yeah, of course. I think definitely. Now, don't get me wrong. I grew up with the Adam West Batman on the TV show. I started watching the TV show, and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. And really, the past couple of days, I've been wondering about also, like, what it was like for the Batman back in the 40s and the 50s, before there was computers and 15 different Batmobiles that he drove. Because the only Batman I've known is this technologically superiorly advanced Batman. And so what must it have been like when he lived in a time where all he had was really a radio and a typewriter?
Good questions. Dominique, thanks very much for the phone call.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Email from Michael in Cape Coral, Florida. My Batman will always be the often underappreciated Batman the Animated Series. Years later, as an adult, I still watch and enjoy these extremely well-written stories. And Neil Gaiman, I should add, very well drawn, too.
I was about to say, they're not just incredibly well-written, which they were by the likes of Paul Dini and Michael Reeves and so forth, but beautifully designed. And designed in this sort of glorious, futuristic, retro kind of way, taking everything down to basics and to just beautiful lines. I love the Batman Animated Series. I think it was wonderful.
Congratulations on the Newbery Medal. Can you tell us what you're working on now?
What am I working on now? I'm writing a bunch of short stories, working on a film script for Anansi Boys, my last novel, my last adult novel, and working on a nonfiction book, my first nonfiction book for about 22 years, which is about China and Chinese myth and the legend of the journey to the West. And that's what I'm working on this week.
That all sounds fascinating. And after this most recent book, you have to remember to say my most recent book, not my last one.
I do. I really do.
Neil Gaiman, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it. And good luck with whatever happened to the Cape Crusader.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Neil Gaiman joined us out of the deluxe edition of the Whatever Happened to the Cape Crusader is out in comic book stores today, next week in most bookstores. You can preview some of the artwork at our website at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation.